Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
It's pledge season on Slate Podcasts. If you love the Slate Culture Gabfest, you can help support it by joining Slate Plus at slate.com/culture plus. We'll be talking about it more later in the show.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest live from Toronto edition. Greetings, polite, bilingual, multicultural, tolerant, nanny, statist friends. We are your new American overlords. It's Wednesday, September 20th, 2017. On today's show, Justin Trudeau is arguably the leader of the free world, and as such, he is bearer of the virtues of democracy and the Enlightenment. But far more critically, he's clickbait. What is it about the hunky boy king that generates memes? And then Joni Mitchell is a great, if not the greatest, singer-songwriter of both or any conceivable gender. But what is it about her that confounds critics? We ask a great critic we are lucky to have on hand, Slate's own Carl Wilson, whose essay on Joni Mitchell appears in the current issue of Book Forum. And then Mudbound premiered at Sundance and was screened at this week's Toronto Film Festival. It is a violent, poignant, intense period epic about two families, one black, one white. We discuss this remarkable film with its director, Dee Rees. And finally, on Slate Plus, restaurant tricks and memoirist Jen Ag is a Toronto food star, reputationally a bitch, and a very, very good friend of mine. We are extremely excited to talk to her about food and feminism and whatever other topics cross her mind. Joining me today is Slate's editor, Julia Turner. My microphone is sinking slowly.
Yeah.
It's good because I get to talk and gaze at my navel at the same time. I can hold it. It's fine.
Hi, Steve.
Hey, Julia. And, of course, Slate's film critic, Dana Stevens. Hey, Dana.
Hello, Steven.
Let's dig right in. All right. Stipulated, we are the Culture Gabfest, which means we're mostly known for our gross ignorance when it comes to politics. Second, we're Americans, which means we feel mostly a gross and total indifference to the domestic politics of far-flung and exotic places like Canada. To wit, when we were going over whether we would do this segment, we said, Justin Trudeau, is he president or prime minister? Anyway, we don't care. Here is what we do know about him. He is a dreamy 6'2" pile of cookie dough topped by enviably wavy hair, part Prince Hal, part audience favorite on The Bachelorette. And he has taken the internet by storm, generating very funny memes of the Ryan Gosling Hey Girl variety. Julia, I will turn to you and say, what is it about Justin Trudeau, A, that generates the memes, but how is that integrated into a leadership style that's taking on, you know, broader and deeper symbolic power in a Trumpian world?
Obviously, part of it is that he's, like, comically attractive. But it has engendered a set of conversations around the prime minister in the august internal chat channels of Slate that is goofy. And, I will read you a little bit. I was trying to ask my colleagues, what are the conversations we have about Justin Trudeau? We've had several convos here that end with either me or another employee saying that we eagerly await the Justin Trudeau sex scandal, or we compare him to Macron. Oh, yes, we had such a good conversation about him and Macron's relative hotness. I feel like the Trudeau stuff was, as with most things, the most fun before Trump. That was when it could be enjoyed most purely, when he named a gender equitable cabinet and when he popped out of a cave. And then there is one lone holdout who says, basically, I think he's a cynical narcissist who gets woke praise for progressive layups and for deliberately being shirtless all the time.
I think you found the room, as they say.
The person who holds that belief will be very gratified by that hearty applause. But, you know, we talk so much in the United States about the social media president that we have. We have this Twitter leader monster, sorry about that, who is, you know, been corrupting our entire country and endangering the safety of the world through the kind of corrosive conversation that's happening on Twitter. But in a way, you guys have a social media leader too, and that I wonder if that isn't also troubling in a less toxic way. What do you guys make of it?
Yeah, you know, looking over all these memes and thinking about, I mean, obviously what we're limited to here is, as Americans who know very little about the way the country is being run, we're talking about his symbolic power on the internet, right? And I kept thinking about something, I think many people have said this, but I know one of my professors in college had this idea that the president in the U.S. is like the country's husband, you know? They've always been men, so we haven't yet known what it is to have the country's wife, but that, you know, that there's this kind of erotic domestic relationship that the populace has as a whole with this kind of symbolic figure of the president. And if that's true for us right now in the U.S., and this has been said by a lot of people too, we're kind of in an abusive relationship, right? Like we have this monster in the house who's completely unpredictable and quixotic and sort of potentially violent and frightening. And you guys, on the other hand, seem like the symbolic power of the figure in the office of prime minister is somehow balanced in between the bae, right? The woke bae kind of figure that's being invoked in those memes. And, well, the biggest applause that we got in the room just now was the idea that he's kind of a smoke and mirrors, you know, mm-hmm. that there's like there's an emptiness right. behind that facade. And I don't know quite where else to go with that, but yeah, it has to do with not quite knowing if the man in the house is the man you think he is.
I think it also has to do with an ambivalence about how and on what terms we lend authority and legitimacy to public figures, especially leaders, especially men, right? There's a crisis of masculinity. We used to have, you know, for hundreds of years, a certain kind of, you know, voice of public authority that was a combination of the president and an anchorman, you know, kind of white, Protestant-derived, European-descended male with an oaky, authoritative voice. And at moments of public emergency or great public import, that was comforting in some way. And that's more of a sort of a father relationship. And when you look at the evolution of media, you have FDR as a radio president. There was something about that patrician voice during a depression that was quite comforting. You have Reagan as a maestro of television in a way that no president had been before him, and the theater of television. And at moments when public grief, for example, in the aftermath of the Challenger fiasco, when public grief needed to be expressed, Reagan was actually pretty good at it. I mean, I disapprove of virtually everything else about him, but as a performer of public legitimacy in a time of confusion, he was quite good. What I wonder is, woke bae Justin Trudeau speaks somehow to a desire for masculine normativity absent masculine authority or gravitas, and how is that going to respond when it's tested? And interestingly, a lot of its power derives from the, you know, antipodal contrast to Trump, and yet does he have the authority to really counterweight the U.S. that's spinning off its axis?
I mean, it seems like that's probably a better question for the people in this room than for us. But I mean it really
in terms of public symbolism, the culture of it rather than the politics of it.
I guess I would argue the opposite, that sort of both Trump and Trudeau are finding different ways to create that relationship with their audiences, and it's less through the broad, you know, kind of the single solitary authoritarian broadcast and more through these very loose, informal seeming touch points. Like, they're just kayaking up to you all over the internet all the time, like wanting to reach out to you individually. Both of them, honestly, I mean, they're kind of more alike than you might think in the way that they're omnipresent and like to seem off the cuff. And the kind of performed off the cuffness that we now require, honestly, of all public figures. I mean, we expect it from celebrities. We want them to like show us the pancakes they're making for their kids in the kitchen on their Instagrams. We now also want it from our politicians, and I actually think for both men, the question of how you square the off-the-cuffness mm-hmm. with the authority holds.
Mm-hmm. Well, and in a way, the reality TV origin sort of holds more for Trudeau than I had realized. It wasn't until I started researching him to talk about him on this show that I learned about this boxing match, which I guess everybody in Canada is more than familiar with. Remind me of the guy he was boxing? Patrick Brazeau, right. And so the idea that his political career, it didn't begin there, but that it sort of took off in a very public way in a literal beatdown of another politician is very Trumpian in his way.
And it seemed like he plotted and lied in wait, like lay in wait for, yeah.
No, the descriptions of the boxing match to someone who really wasn't that familiar with the details are astonishing. I mean, the seriousness with which, like, Trudeau was able to take the opening flurry of haymakers, and yet he found his legs and then his jab, and he was able to slowly work, you know, his opponents.
His endurance and hard work propelled him through, Steve.
Right, and the idea, the kind of unproblematized idea in interviews that he gave about it, that was proof of his mettle mm-hmm. as a politician, right? It showed that he was a hard worker and that he was dedicated.
And this raises a place I'd like us to go before we exit the segment, which is, you know, I mean, I was reading about the boxing match, I kept thinking, and I thought my country was stupid. Right? And there is a way in which Canada and the United States, if you look on the map, were right next to each other. No, sorry.
I'm sure the library is really glad they flew us up here to tell them that.
I don't know where that came from, but let's stipulate finally, my last stipulation for the night, I promise, is that there's a social psychology that goes on between the two countries that involves a yin and a yang, a kind of distribution of social psychological functions in a way. And when we have a nightmare president like Trump, there's a kind of directional shift, and Americans, speaking for myself at least, look to Canada longingly as the country of sensible shoes, you know, pragmatism, consensus politics, a degree of tolerance that, you know, may have miles to go, but compared to the United States is really remarkable. When we have Obama, I think my sense is that it flips in a way, and Canada feels like maybe, how does Canada feel? Do you look longingly at us when we have Barack Obama? You're fine. You'll be okay. Right. Right. So this is all about my own pathetic inner life and not about... Yes, you're nodding rather vigorously, ma'am. The point is, Dana, just throw me any kind of a fucking lifeline right now. What?
Well, here's a question I have. So basically, a bunch of people, when Trump began to seem like he was gaining traction in the election and we began to contemplate that he might actually win,
honestly rarely contemplated that until election day.
Yeah, but anyways, it seemed clear that something was working. There were a few pieces, I think Slate ran one, of like, well, so how would folks on the left feel if like a kind of canny social media star from the left, like what if Kanye ran for president? Like what if someone else who was like a good image maker but who espoused liberal values instead of conservative ones? How would we feel about that? Basically, that experiment is already being conducted in mm-hmm. Canada because he employs all these flim-flam tactics, and yet the things that he chooses to say with the platform that he's acquired for himself are about tolerance and inclusion and, you know, maybe let's not talk about the pipelines, but the general baseline things he's using his flim-flammery to advance, at least from where we sit, look pretty great. And that's the future that seems interesting to contemplate from where we sit is, you know, how if this is the future of what politicking is, how will we feel about it when it's applied towards evil and good? Like, what, you know, is mm-hmm. is there a way to deploy it well? And I think probably it's a little too soon to say what he'll actually be able to achieve, but that's the question I have.
Well, and this is a lot to get into, but another specter that his ascension raises is that of dynastic power, right? I mean, one of the big sort of marks against Hillary, like, among people that hated her, was that there was something dynastic about the Clintons and that she was just coming up because of her husband. Obviously, Justin Trudeau is, you know, crowned by his father's prime ministership before him. So So to balance that as well with what seems to be this this woke bae coming out with his boxing gloves on, you know, I mean, those two things marry together in a way that's maybe a little bit disturbing as well, the inherited power and the retail politician skill.
Mm-hmm. Right. I'm still curious to know, and we won't solve it in this segment, which was now coming to a close, is just what when, you know, when the some combination of the late night comedians and the general psyche of the public projects a set of images or expectations on a leader, they're empowering him to do X or disempowering and limiting him from doing X. And I'm just still very curious to know, and maybe our Canadian listeners or otherwise politically literate ones can come to facebook.com/culturefest and tell us, is he being limited or empowered and to do what or not do what? I'd be very curious to hear it. All right, moving on.
Hi, guys. We're cutting into our Toronto show to let you know that it is Pledge Week on Slate Podcasts for Slate Plus. And here to discuss that back in the studio through the magic of time travel and zithers, we have Slate Plus editorial director Gabriel Roth. Hi, Gabe.
Hey, Julia. Hi, Dana. Hi, Steve. This week is special because it's Pledge Week on Slate Podcasts. That means we here at Slate are asking podcast listeners who have not already joined Slate Plus to support the shows they love. Now, if the show that you love is this show, the Culture Gabfest, there's a very special way you can sign up for Slate Plus and help support the Culture Gabfest. What is that way, Julia?
You can use the code slate.com/culture plus. Slate.com/culture plus. Note, if you were a Slate Plus member, you would not be hearing this pledge drive right now. You would just be listening to content, zipping along. That's one of the benefits you can get if you sign up at slate.com/culture plus. However, there is also a contest. And that contest pits each Slate podcast against all of the other Slate podcasts. Dana, would you like for the Slate Culture Gabfest to be victorious?
We must prevail. You know, I'm the least competitive person on this podcast by far. We've talked about my resistance to games and sports of all kinds, but are you kidding me? We have to crush them all in the contest and get the most signups.
So here's the thing. We've got this contest where each of the Slate podcast is trying to convert as many of its listeners to Slate Plus as possible. And we're going to weigh this out according to the average size of the audience, right? So the big juggernauts, the Political Gabfest, the oldest, biggest show, in pure numerical terms, maybe they'll convert the most people. But in terms of the fierceness of your devotion, the avidity of your loyalty to the show, you have a chance to represent for Culture. One of the people who signs up using the code slate.com/culture plus will be eligible to get whatever the modern version is of our voice on your home answering machine.
Do you have a friend, perhaps, or a spouse who might enjoy receiving a voicemail message in the dulcet tones of Dana Stevens? I bet you do.
What about Steve Metcalf reads a Robert Frost poem in his Robert Frost voice into your voicemail?
The shattered water made a misty din.
He's giving the content away for free.
Steve, bottle it up.
Just a little sample. Of the prize that you could be receiving if you sign up for Slate Plus using that URL, again, slate.com/culture plus.
This has been a lot of japery, but just a serious note, we're really counting on you guys to support Slate, to help make us financially independent, to help us to do all the journalism that we do at a moment when journalism is incredibly important. So please, if you value this show, if you listen to us week in and week out, it's $35 for your first year, $50 every year after. It's an amount that I hope you will consider giving to support this work and get benefits like not listening to segments like this. Slate.com/culture plus. All right, back to the show.
Thanks, guys.
Let me welcome to the stage the wonderful Carl Wilson.
Hi. Hi, guys.
Hey, man. Welcome back.
Thank you.
You're a supreme EFOP. A supreme, extreme friend of the program.
I like that FOP is in that engram. That's my favorite part of it.
Of the show?
Thanks. Just you know, the gathering of FOPs that we are.
Yeah, the weekly gathering of FOPs. All right, in 1971, says critic Carl Wilson, Joni Mitchell kicked off One of Those Runs, a series of albums in the record guides with 5 stars attached to each one of the titles, one after the other over a period of whatever it was, 7 or 10 years, starting in the late 60s with Clouds, then Ladies of the Canyons, then, of course, Blue, one of the great, I mean, truly maybe the greatest record ever made, Court and Spark, For the Roses, on and on, through a more complex kind of troubling her own sound with Hissing of the Summer Lawns and Hegira. These albums are on par, obviously, with Blood on the Tracks or Harvest or really any piece of popular art ever made, arguably many of them are. And yet her reputation feels unsettled. Is this because she's a woman, a Canadian, considered something of an infamous crank, or almost too much of a genius for her own good to discuss? I welcome Carl Wilson once more.
Thanks, Steve.
Carl, that's a great essay you wrote, but before we dig in, why don't you pick a Joni track?
Yeah, I thought I would start, you know, Joni's not a Toronto artist, but very briefly she was, and in the way of all things Canadian, that allows us to claim her forever. So I thought I would choose a song that she wrote in the mid-60s in the time that she was around here, an early song called Urge for Going.
I'll ply the fire with kindling now. I'll pull the blankets up to my chin. I'll lock the vagrant winter out and I'll bolt my wandering in. I'd like to call back summertime and have her stay for just another month or so. But she's got the urge for going, so I guess she'll have to go.
Thematically, I mean, I don't want to spend much of this time rebutting or complicating your Justin Trudeau segment, but I think one of the things to think about in terms of where Canadian artists begin from and where Canadian politics begin from, I would differ with the room in a lot of ways that there isn't a reaction, attraction, repulsion relationship with America that's always going on. And I think Toronto is particularly prey to that. And our self-image is created kind of in contrast to that. My Trudeau footnote would be that we might have been outgrowing that, and Trudeau may be a kind of gossamer, out-of-date recollection to this kind of Canadian superiority complex. Mm. But anyway, my essay was based around this new biography of Joni called Reckless Daughter by David Yaffe, which I have mixed feelings about. One thing that you feel incredibly strongly reading it is the historical situation that she was in and the way that her rapid progress from rural Saskatchewan, from a very, very sort of remote post-war, kind of nothing culturally, to savvily getting to the late 60s where she was advancing the art of songwriting in ways that certainly no women of the decade were doing in quite the same way, and none of the men really either, is this trajectory that's really quite remarkable to contemplate. And you know, we're maybe now at the historical remove to think about it a little more clearly.
Mm-hmm. And just to talk for a second about what's so utterly distinctive about what she does. There's something about the tuning of the guitar, the chord progressions that she then, you know, iterates out off of those tunings, and therefore, like, the architecture of the song is unusual. It's not something you hear anyplace else. On top of which, the melodies aren't only just sort of bewitching, they're also sophisticated and complex in ways that they couldn't otherwise be if the architecture beneath them weren't so, in its own weird way, recondite, but not at all unpleasant. I mean, immediately catchy tunes, but built out of something completely newfangled.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to deconstruct all the things that happened in that rapid period of growth. But one of the things, I think, is that she was a rock and roll teenager from a conservative family who basically had nothing but a few classical albums and some show tunes in the house, all of which she really liked and carried with her, came into the folk scene kind of a bit as a joke. Like, it was a hobby while she was going to art school. And everything changed because she got pregnant and fled the West, basically so her parents wouldn't know that she was pregnant, gave up the child and began writing songs. And the biography is interesting on this. It's disputable how this works, but one of the things is that she had childhood polio, as did Neil Young, by the way, and she found a lot of guitar positions difficult in terms of physical strength. Another part of it is that she was, by her own admission, at every phase in her life, a terrible student and didn't really have the patience or desire to be taught, particularly by these guys in the folk scene, how to play guitar. So she kind of rapidly found ways to adapt it to sounds that she wanted. And then I think out of that, just instinctively seeking sounds that appealed to her, she found these unconventional chord structures that reach back to jazz and reach back to classical and appeal to a sense of melody that she has that is kind of underrated, perhaps in the Bob Dylan era, and trying to bring all of those things together in this really instinctive and not particularly concerned about what anybody else thinks ways. And she says that when she started writing songs, you know, she started off as a bit of a imitator of Joan Baez style folk music. And as soon as she was writing her own words, she started to feel like her voice started to change. And within a few years, it had changed utterly and was like unlike anybody else's.
You know who I thought of when you're talking about her building her style, her music songwriting style out of the lack of training that she had was one of Julia's favorites, Liz Phair, who also has very strange chord structures and an odd way of constructing a song that she often says came about just simply because she hadn't come up boy style, you know, learning rhythm and blues and then piling these things on top of it that she kind of came at it sideways and had to invent her own.
Yeah,
style.
I mean, the amount to which she wasn't a musician as a teenager is really, there aren't that many boys in the field that you can compare it to. Like, she just didn't do it at all. And then suddenly she was, and suddenly she was playing better than anybody. And there's this remarkable thing, which I realized at some point in the biography, where suddenly she's playing piano in the, like, late 60s, early 70s. And you're like, wait, the last I knew of her touching a piano was when she quit piano lessons angrily when she was 8 because her teacher hit her with a ruler. And there's never a mention of her ever touching a piano again. And suddenly she's playing this very fluid piano. And it's like, where did that come from? And every moment of her story feels very like that. I mean, and we could talk about, there are some ways in which that's also this kind of Canadian outsiderness that I think that she brings, which is a certain freedom from the entertainment industry, I think that's very unlikely in an American context. And I think all of those 60s Canadian and early 70s Canadian singer-songwriters bring a little bit of that distance to the whole project and find voices that are a little unusual from that.
You talk a little bit in your piece about this, but I'd be curious to hear you elaborate on the unsettled legacy. I mean, I hadn't quite thought about how much I hadn't thought about Joni Mitchell till I read your piece, if that makes sense. Like, she's, how come she didn't get nominated for a Nobel? How come she, I mean, she's obviously, no one would ever say she's mediocre or bad. She's like she's like so frighteningly talented. I honestly find her somewhat terrifying. I feel like she's sitting there kind of like, with her hand on like the third rail of life's ineluctable melancholy and just like daring you to grab it and just like, hang, come with me to the dark place. Like, and then meanwhile, she sings so like an angel that like I feel ashamed to sing along because it's like, why would anyone try to sing?
Julia, I have to interrupt here and just say that's the first time in the history of this show that I've ever heard you place your hand on the third rail of life's ineluctable melancholy.
I don't do it. That's why she terrifies me. But she
must have really fucked with your head, is what I'm trying to say.
Well, her robot body would conduct the electricity extra hard.
Yeah, nobody touched Julia. Step away from Julia.
Anyway, she's obviously quite a powerful artist, but it is true that she doesn't quite have that. You know, she's been a little bit betwixt and between, and it's hard to tell whether it's because of the gender thing or because she's grown into kind of an ornery old lady, as she predicted. But I'd be curious to hear you assess the dynamics there.
Yeah, I mean, as you were saying, she sort of started talking about this before she even turned 30 and started predicting that she was going to be an ornery old lady. And I think that was her already reacting to the reactions that she was getting, and maybe also being somebody a little more uncomfortable with fame than most celebrities.
Although, what is Bob Dylan if not an ornery old man?
Yeah, but the difference is that we don't begrudge at him, right? Like, that's the thing that feels all the way along from the sort of sexist condescension and sort of, you know, wolf eyes ogling that she got in the music press when she was in her 20s to the blame on her for daring to change stylistically and embrace jazz sounds and new sets of musicians and all the things that she did in the 70s to the, like, extreme reaction for her daring to be political or a little nasty mouthed about her peers and all of that kind of thing as she got older. all of these things feel like, yes, these are parts of reasons for her reputation, but you can't help feel that they're all gendered, that again, we just don't treat any of those other sort of legends of that time the same way that we do her. And even though, no, as you say, nobody denies her greatness, nobody denies her influence, basically the kind of entire tradition of white women singer-songwriter, you know, really stems directly from her, and you can't point anywhere else, and nobody would deny it. But, you know, one thing I've noticed with millennial audiences is that they talk constantly about Stevie Nicks and almost never about Joni Mitchell. And I feel like that is this sense of, like, that got too complicated. There's not, you know, there's not a simple icon to deal with. And it's a bit of a cliche to talk about Joni Mitchell because Lilith Fair Girls talked about Joni Mitchell in the 90s, but also, like, we don't know how to take the full measure of Joni Mitchell, and we feel like we can take the measure of Stevie Nicks. And so it's a really muddy legacy in that way.
I think you really saw that come out. Remember when she almost died a couple of years ago, right? She had a brain aneurysm or something.
Yeah,
she was in the hospital.
Yeah.
And so people thought that that might be, you know, the last days of Joni Mitchell. And there was this outpouring of talk and love about her. But there was also, especially because of the crank that she embodies, but because of that, maybe, yeah, there was a kind of stepping away from the absolute lionization that you would expect of a figure like that if it really was true that she was on her last legs.
I mean, I think there are some people whose reputation is already so, you sense that they're, that, you know, they're already deeded over to posterity, right? So we, the living, have nothing relevant to say about them. We understand that they've been handed over to the future, and the future will make quite a lot of them. And you don't feel this way, with all due respect, about Stevie Nicks. So it's safe to have a kind of friendly canonization, living canonization of her in a way that's mildly condescending, but you can't mildly condescend to Joni Mitchell. And there's this sense in which the second that we hear she's gone, which hopefully is many, 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 many years in the future, we'll suddenly be liberated unto our awe at what she's accomplished.
Yeah, absolutely, that's true. But, it, you know, one thing is that I don't think that's many, many, many years in the future. By all signs, her health has been bad for quite a while, and that last scare was very severe, and she's apparently recovered to the point that she gets around in a wheelchair now, but that's the point 2 years later that she's recovered to. So a little bit the way that we talked at the end of 2016 about, you know, on Slate, we did this tribute to Stevie Wonder for the very purpose of, like, do this so that he's not dead when we do it. Because we'd lost so many people in 2016 and thought about how they didn't hear the appreciation that they got. I feel like that a little bit about Joni, and I'm glad this biography, flawed as it is out, because I feel like it'd be nice if we came around to celebrating that legacy before it was just all in obituaries.
Yeah, beautifully said. So, Blue is one of those records that I just don't think anybody's collection is complete without, you know, regardless of what the focus of your own particular interests or tastes happen to be. Most people have it. If they don't, they should get it. Give us, before we close off here, give us a record that even Joni Mitchell fans like me might not have or might not know that should be added. I sprung this on you by surprise, so you can...
My answer to this is the most contrarian answer possible.
Blue.
Predictably, no.
Buy a second copy of Blue.
Yeah, you don't really know Blue.
Yeah.
When I started taking records out of the public library, I think first I took out Court and Spark, and then I thought, oh, what's this one? And it was Mingus, which is probably her most demonized of classic period records, if we don't talk about the sort of synthesizer and political rant dominated records of the mid-80s. And I, you know, coming to it innocent of why people would say that this folk singer shouldn't collaborate with the jazz great of the 20th century, just thought it was amazing. So I do feel like it definitely takes more time to penetrate. But I think now that Hissing of Summer Lawns and Hejira are a little more canonized than they were in their time, then it's not as much of a stretch for people to get into Mingus. With all of its touches on Joni's weird race fetishization elements, which definitely float through it, but just her as a jazz singer dealing with a bop-centered kind of harmonics, it's really an incredible thing, and you have to listen to like 10-minute-long songs.
Lester took him a wife. Arm in arm went black and white, and some so red.
Yeah, fantastic, Mingus. All right, well, Carl Wilson, thank you so much for coming back on the show. You really...
Thank you so much.
All right, well, our next guest, Dee Reese, is the director and co-writer of Mudbound and previously Pariah, an HBO biopic of Bessie Smith. Please welcome to the stage. We are so pleased to have her, Dee Reese. Mudbound is a period drama. It tells the stories of two families, the McCallan family and the Jackson family, one white, one black, who together relocate to a farm in the Deep South right around the time of the Second World War. Each family has a son who serves in the war. Each of them courageously, though returning to America, they are offered radically different homecomings. Netflix bought the film for a handsome sum at Sundance. It's been screened at this week's Toronto Film Festival. Its cast includes Mary J. Blige, Carey Mulligan, Garrett Hedlund, Jason Mitchell, and Jason Clarke. Before we dig in, why don't we listen to and watch a clip?
How long have you been back from overseas?
Oh, just a couple of weeks. Much obliged, Miss Triplebanks. You give yourself a wonderful day.
Take care.
It's all right. It's just a car. It must have backfired. They say it stops eventually.
Just come back. Come all the way back.
My nightmare's always the same. I scream. But it's nothing coming out.
This place, this law, we don't belong to them.
So I managed in the space of my short introduction two misrepresentations. The first is the Jackson family's already down in Mississippi. They don't relocate there. But the second one, which was sort of intentional, is this is a movie in the best possible way without a MacGuffin. It's really not built around any one relationship or pairing. It's really not exclusively about any one point of view or plot line. It really is about being a brother, being a soldier, being a mother, being an evil patriarch, being an American, being dispossessed, having possession of land or wanting possession of land. It's just a remarkable achievement because it is so many things in the span of whatever it is, 2+ hours. Was that daunting? I should say it's based on source material and novel. You went into this having read the novel and knowing you were making a large film with a lot of elements. I'm very curious to talk to you just as a film director about what it's like to begin with a novel which is sprawling and large, it has epic scope, and to turn that into something that people can experience in 120 minutes, that just strikes me as remarkable.
Wow, thanks. Yeah, I mean, the thing that attracted me to it was the multiple points of view, and the thing that I responded to in Hillary's writing was the internal monologue, so more than the dialogue, I was interested in like this kind of inner monologues each character would have in these inner churns, and then I even wrote some original monologue for Hap and Florence to kind of like give those characters more depth, but for me, like I get attracted to relationships and characters, and so that's what I kind of go in with first, and I love that, you know, you could think this is a story about two brothers, and then we figure out, no, it's not about two brothers, and you think, okay, this could be a story about a marriage falling apart, and it's like, it's not just that, and then you think, oh, this is a story about sharecroppers and landowners, and like, no, it's not that. And then you think, oh, wait, it's about these two soldiers. So I think the big risk in this kind of material is that it can very easily become nobody's story. Mm-hmm. And so that was, you know, a big, you know, edit, like the editing room. And we wanted this to be everybody's story. And I wanted to kind of capture this dark symbiosis, or you could even say like a parasitic relationship between these two families who are kind of locked in this system. And so with each kind of, you know, they're kind of like this dark mirror of each other in that, you know, the sons are linked by trauma. The mothers are linked by economic kind of disempowerment, where their husbands are kind of making the financial decisions, but the wives are going around them. And then the two men, the two, you know, husbands are united by this sense of disinheritance. So I just like all the struggle. And I also wanted to show like poor whites. So you have like the Atwood family that are in the novel, and it's important to show, you know, the McCallan's discomfort with them. So we see the middle class whites who are not comfortable with the poor whites and how they're all in the muck together, and the mud just becomes like a metaphor for race for the system we're all stuck in.
And I want to emphasize that at the center of all of it is you, right? Like, to the extent mm-hmm. that there's coherence mm-hmm. and narrative tension throughout, that really is the hand of a director and a confident one, which is a remarkable achievement. But another question, just as mm-hmm. someone who's amazed that someone can direct a movie, is you have it on the page, you know, really remarkably that you could at the end of such a chaotic and contingent process end up with something that's aesthetically unified and internally unified. But among the miraculous things that you must have to do as a director, you've got it on the page, and let's say you even have it perfectly on the page. You're then handing it over to a team of artists who are autonomous artists in their own right. This is an extraordinary ensemble piece. Talk a little bit about your actors and the performances, and we have to talk about Mary J. Blige.
Yeah, no, totally. So it's like seven actors, and like, first of all, they're like generous because it's like no one's necessarily like the lead, but it was just important to get people that could really like stand and look at each other and like hold ground. And also, like, you know, casting is like the biggest part of directing, but I think sometimes it gets undone if you don't have producers that back you up. And, you know, in making films, there's such a pressure to have, you know, certain names that justify a budget. And so, you know, with this film, like, we had big names, but the producers also really just let me have it. And like, for example, like with Rob Morgan as Hap, I was like, you don't know Rob Morgan, you've never heard of him in your life, but he's going to be Hap and he's going to be great.
He's so good.
And so like things like that, like impacted. And so, you know, I was really interested in having faces that felt like they were from the period. So I cast a lot with look also. So for Mary J. Blige, like, she has this like tear shaped scar. And so I wanted to film this perpetual tear, and she's beautiful. And like, I needed someone for Florence who could have this vulnerability and like this deeply empathic kind of sense of the world, but then also be able to put up a wall and have this reserve. And Mary's character absolutely like Mary nails it. Like, she really like goes inside, and you know, she stripped away the makeup, no wig, no anything. And Florence doesn't says everything she thinks, but you see all the time like this life in her eyes. And like, she was so far into character, like even like some of her co-stars didn't know it was her. Like, there's this young kid who's playing like her son, who's sitting like from here to there to her. And so we're doing scenes, and like when I'm on set, I call actors generally by the character's name, and I slipped and said Mary, and he's like, wait a minute, You're Mary J. Blige? Wait, you're Mary J. Blige. Wait, no. And so I was like, okay, Gilbert kid, like, now we gotta, like, go. But it's kind of funny because he was, like, holding forth before saying, oh, yes, I've done this, and next I'm doing that, and da-da-da. So it kind of, like, quieted a little bit down after that. But and he was, like, silent for, like, the rest of the day. But like, Jason Clark plays Henry, and I was looking for a swaggering, salt-of-the-earth kind of guy. And
it had to have been a physically arduous shoot, too, right? I mean, there's lots of mud, there's lots of rain. Was it something that was kind of a hardship to get through in terms of the weeks on the set?
It was horrible. It was bad. It was so we shot out in plantation country in Louisiana. So though the story is set in Mississippi, we shot in Louisiana. In this weird way, like, we scouted Mississippi, but they didn't like hold on to a lot of those historical places. Like, they like raised them or got rid of them. And Louisiana, in this weird, like, weirdly, proudly, like, had memorialized it, which maybe is good because they're, like, I guess not forgetting it. And so we shot at this old sugar plantation, and we convinced a farmer, you know, to let us, like, ruin, like, one of their fields. Like, you just pay for the crop. And so, you know, we had to create our own mud with water trucks. But it was so hot, it was the middle of July, so the moment we'd, like, make mud, the sun would bake it and be like a crust. And so, like, you know, we finished one direction, we had to bring back the water trucks, make it mud again, and, you know, instead of greensmen, we had brownsmen, whose job was to just, like, make the mud and try to keep continuity and then sweep out, like, tire tracks. So it was, like, a pain. And then there's, like, mosquitoes, and it's buggy, and we shot in actual sharecropper cabins. Our production
designers... Oh, so you didn't make those structures? They were there?
Yes, yeah, so they're pre-existing. So that was the thing. Like, they like preserved all those things. And so our production designer was David Bamba. And so we convinced the landowner to let us move the sharecropper cabins deeper into the field, because where they originally sited was too close to the road and too close, you could see the levee. And so we moved them back into the field, so where they weren't meant to be. So then he had to make them safe. And that meant transporting in and out. You're driving across land that's not meant to be driven on. So, and we won, you know, the DP was Rachel Morris, and we wanted to have these 360 views, which means that, like, the production needed to be, like, very far away to become a dot, which means that if you want a C-stan, you know, it's going to be a minute. So it was just, like, all around arduous, but I think that kind of informed the whole spirit of it.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like a sprawling production and a sprawling theme. That sounds amazing.
Yeah, totally. And we shot some days in Budapest, too.
Sorry?
Oh, so we shot some stuff in Budapest, too.
For the war stuff.
Yeah, for the war stuff,
Well, that both of those actually kind of lead me to my other big point of curiosity about the movie, which has to do with the trajectory of your career. So your first feature film was Pariah, right?
Mm-hmm.
Pariah, great movie. Thanks. It came out about 6 years ago.
Thanks.
And Pariah, for those who haven't seen it, is an ultra, ultra low budget, right? Mm-hmm. It's under $500,000
movie. Yeah, it's like 400-something K, and we never had all the money at the same time.
Right.
We would get it in trips, and we just kept going. Yeah.
Right, and it's very local. It all takes place in Brooklyn. It's basically about one person. It's a coming-of-age, coming-out story. Mm-hmm. It's very intimate and small. And so I'm just curious. And then your two films after that are Bessie, which is a pretty big historical, mm-hmm. Period kind of biopic, and then suddenly you're doing this multi-generational epic where you've got World War II tanks on set, and so obviously in terms of scale, you moved up really fast, and I'm just curious, as a director, what was that like to go from ultra micro-budget indie to suddenly, get us a tank in Budapest? And
Yeah. I mean, I just wanted to blow shit up, honestly, so it was good. So, it was cool. It was great, and it was, it was just, to me, like, budget buys you in this case, budget usually buys you time, but this budget didn't really buy us time. We shot in 30 days. Budget can buy you equipment. Budget buys you crew. But budget doesn't buy you better performances. So for me, I just focus on the performances and, like, the relationships and, like composition and blocking. Like, all those kind of basic craft things don't change. So, the budget is kind of irrelevant in a way, except that it gives you able to shoot in Budapest and use real tanks and have explosives. And, we shot there because they kept all that old stuff, same here. Like, whereas we'd have like two tanks if we tried to do it, in the South, we could have like 10 tanks in Budapest for the same price, which was a little scary. And then the special effects guys there were willing to do crazier stuff. It's like, if you do black smoke, it's not supposed to be, but so big, but they're like, oh, no problem, And so, you're talking to a translator and hoping that what you're saying is translating, and I'm just making a lot of hand motions, and it was great. And we had, and so all the American soldiers are actually Hungarian soldiers, but, you just kind of, make it work.
You shot this in the summer of 2016, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what was it like to make a movie on these themes and on the parasitical relationship and the mud that we're all stuck in, as I think you put it at the beginning, as Trump's campaign began to prosper and he became the nominee, and then eventually, I guess you were done shooting by the time he won, but how much did you think about our present political moment in shaping the film and in shooting it?
Well, while we were shooting, the script first came to me in 2015, and it was kind of like, I was already reeling from all these police killings, and so it was already in the air, and so Trump's rise just felt like, we told you so. This is what we've been saying for the past 5 years with police killings. This country, has this subconscious, it's I think it's a psychosis, we haven't dealt with, and we all need therapy, and things have not changed. And so as we made the film, it just felt this is now. It doesn't feel like a period piece. I think whether it was set in 1940 or 2040 would be commenting on the moment. And I just felt like there was one moment where I forget which shooting it was. There's so many shootings, but there was one where a police officer was acquitted, and it was the morning we were going to shoot the scene with a little girl aiming her stick at the car. And I was so angry, and we were supposed to scout a field for the Ronzel night chase. We're shooting that scene that day. And I was so angry, and it was perfect to shoot those scenes that day. So that bang, you're dead. That just felt like me, just my ultimate expression, because it, as just a citizen, I don't know, I felt helpless. It felt like, what can we do? We keep raising our hand and saying this is happening, but no one's listening. And so it just felt like that whole rise and maybe his election pulled the tablecloth off the thing that was already there. And maybe, I don't know, we as Americans will finally just acknowledge what's there. And in this film, I think you could read it on a deeper conceptual level, about inheritance, and you need to acknowledge what you've inherited, or you acknowledge what you're passing on, or it just continues in perpetuity. So yeah, it was just it was a good outlet. I'm just glad I was making something, during the time, because if I wasn't making something, I don't know what I'd be doing.
That inheritance theme is so powerful in it, but I think the other way that I am excited for people to encounter it and read it is just as a World War II film. I mean, it's a World War II film that tracks both how dislocating the experience is, but comparatively the experience of a black and white soldier, in a way where it feels like there's a lot of glamorizing films about World War II. There's a lot of, there's not a lot. There are a very few films about the Black experience in World War II, but I haven't never seen one that plays them side by side in the way that your film does, and it was very powerful.
Yeah, like I was hoping to get behind the mythology of the Greatest Generation, and people like romanticize this period, and like I think this is the period Trump is talking about when he says "Make America Great Again," but it's like that premise is flawed. Like there was never an again, you know. It's like when is the again? Like name one decade when it was great for everybody, you know? Like I was like, why will no one ask him when is again? You know, I was like waiting for someone to, like journalists, like somebody ask him what again, but nobody ever did. But this film felt like, oh, this is the again. Like this is what he wants to get back to, but and showing that. You know, the vestiges of things that are keeping like this one family kind of locked into place. And I just wanted to just, in like both my grandfathers served in different wars, like my paternal grandfather served in Korea and he was from this town called like Fayetteville, Tennessee. And when he came back, he tried to go to Chicago, you know, as part of that migration pattern, didn't work out in Chicago. He ended up in Nashville, Tennessee. And then my mother's dad went to World War II and he was from this town called Ringgold, Louisiana. And so instead of coming back, they ended up going to Oakland. And my grandmother, who's, you know, who a lot of her kind of like spirit is there. Like she was born in Faraday, Louisiana in 1925. And when the war came, it opened up like a lot of job opportunities because they started hiring Black people for stuff they ordinarily wouldn't. So she went to California too. And so it just like, for me, was a chance to kind of like interrogate my own personal history and tell those stories. And neither of my grandfathers got what they were supposed to get, you know? So like the GI Bill, like all that stuff, it didn't work that way for them. You know, I think my one granddad got a job at the post office and that was like, this is your gift, you know, like this is your big get. And my grandfather went to the Korean War, came back to be a janitor. And it was like, oh, be grateful to be a janitor at the electric company. Like, that's a good job. So I just want to kind of get behind that mythology and show how with equal effort, with equal, you know, capability, like there's this double standard and like these two families are kind of pitted against that.
Yeah. Well, Mudbound is an extraordinary film. Congratulations on its huge success, which is only going to increase as we go forward. But Dee Reese, thank you so much for coming on the show. This was
thanks for having me.
All right, well, now is the moment in our podcast where we endorse Dana. What do you have?
Extra long wind up in honor of a live show. Very long wind up to the last syllable.
I can
my
go
name.
Much longer.
Okay, so I, as usual, when we come to a another place, another city, especially a foreign country, I like to endorse something that has something to do with that country. But then the question becomes, how can I endorse something that every single person doesn't already know and just not be bringing coals to Newcastle kind of thing? And so I hope that not everyone in Canada knows about this. But even if y'all do, the whole world doesn't, and they should. So this kind of brings together my own personal love and my current project with learning about Canada. So in 1964, Buster Keaton, who I'm writing a book on right now and who's sort of one of my heroes, was 69 years old, and he was only a year and a half or so away from early 1966 when he would die, and he made his last film in Canada. It was with the National Film Board of Canada, and it was a 24-minute short. Does anyone out there know this movie? Yeah? And it's called The Railroader, and it's essentially a silent short. This, in a way, would almost count as his last film that he, in some way, created. He was not the director. He co-directed it with someone else, but he was the one who chose to make it a silent movie to fill it with the kind of gags that he used to do in his own silent movies. And in The Railroader, the idea is that there's sort of a touristic promotion of Canada, and he gets in an old-fashioned rail car, one of those hand cars, you know, and it begins in Halifax, it ends in, I believe, Vancouver, and he just crosses the entire nation, the entire top of the continent, getting into various scrapes, some of which recall some gags from his silent film, some of which play on the landscape around him. And it's a really beautiful, funny, and strange kind of movie to see him all of those years later, 50 years later or so, back in the world of thinking up silent gags. So part of my endorsement is to watch The Railroader, which you can watch on the National Film Board of Canada website, and we'll link to it on our show page. And there's also, I don't know if people who know The Railroader know this, but there's a one-hour-long documentary about the making of this short called Buster Keaton Rides Again that you can also find online, and we'll link to that. And that's really, really wonderful just as it's a sound film. And it's just wonderful as a document of his life. So you see he and his wife kind of camping out on the road as they're making this movie. They're taking a regular rail car, you know, alongside and then shooting during the day in this little hand car thing. And you get to see him just hanging out, smoking cigarettes, telling jokes, playing the ukulele and singing old vaudeville songs. And it's just a really wonderful portrait of Buster Keaton late in his life. So Buster Keaton Rides Again and The Rail Rotter together. Those are my endorsement for Canada.
Oh, that's fantastic. Julia Turner, what do you got?
Well, like Dana, I like to recommend something from our host country. And unlike Dana, I have no illusions that you guys won't already know this. But since, as expressed, Joni Mitchell, though revered, is too frighteningly close to the bone to me, for me, my most sentimentally felt about Canadian song is the song Scott Pilgrim by the band Plumtree. Not from Toronto, but from Canada. Only a smattering of applause. Either you don't like the song or you don't know it. I don't know. But my husband and I played the song in our wedding. It was our recessional. We walked out to the lyrics, I've Liked You for the Longest Time. And it is a great song of this great nation. So thank you all for that.
All right. Well, continuing with the theme, the Canadian band Always. Otherwise pronounced as Always, but I thought I'd add a little cheek. They have a new record out. They formed in Toronto, as you seem to know, in 2011. And the new record is Sue Fucking Perb, as I wrote here earlier this evening. It's called Anti-Socialites. I don't know if you've heard it yet. It's really freaking good. And what's amazing is the debut record was so good. You were like, these guys are freaking awesome. Like, what a great, you know, reverb-y, nostalgia-laden, jangle rock outfit. They popped fully formed onto the scene, and they have made a better record, which I really didn't think was possible. I mean, no slight on the first one, but the everything about it, from the writing to the production to the singing, everything has just gone up a notch. It is a terrific rock and roll record, and it's Canadian. I would like to say that there are very few human beings who carry in their person, in their bearing, the tradition of the Enlightenment, and one of them is the Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor. Thank you.
We
so
have
much
an audience
for that.
Who gives a round of applause for philosophers. I love that so
we
much.
We should give live shows at libraries all the time. It's so awesome.
Best known for what? The book on Hegel, The Sources of the Self. He wrote an essay called The Politics of Recognition, though I may not be getting the title quite right. It seems to me as though even more rare than the person who carries the Enlightenment in his day-to-day being is the person who somehow managed to then take it and imbue the world with it in some a measurably positive way. And Taylor strikes me as one of those people. And anyway, so find yourself some Charles Taylor to read. He wrote a lot of what he wrote or essay in essay form. Important things that he wrote were in essay form. You don't, like, The Sources of the Self is a plinth, but you don't have to start there, but you'd be rewarded even if you did. Thanks, Dana.
Thank you, Stephen.
Thanks, Julia.
Thank you.
And thank you, Toronto. We had a fucking awesome time. All right, I almost always forget to include the show's credits in my live show script, and I did again, but I wrote them out. But a combination of my tortured scrawl and my decreasing eyesight, I'll see if I can do it. But if I can't, you can chime in. All right, you'll find links to some of the things we talked about today at our show page at slate.com/culturefest, or you can email us at culturefest@slate.com or post on our Facebook page, facebook.com/culturefest. Do any of these words ring a bell? Our producer is Benjamin Frisch. Our intern is Daniel Schrader. That is his name, Daniel Schrader. Andy Bowers is the chief content officer of Panoply Network. You can find our show, entire roster of like-minded and unlike-minded shows at panoply.fm. I would be completely remiss if I didn't give huge thanks to Gregory McCormick and the Toronto Public Library and Reference Library for hosting us tonight. And many thanks to Slate Events guru, wonderful Kirsten Holtz, and also to Natalie Kurtz here at the library, who made everything very
Thank
smooth.
Y'all.
We had
Thanks,
a
guys.
Fucking awesome time. Thank you very, very much.
Thanks, Toronto.